I see my time has already started ticking, but that's okay. All right, good afternoon, everyone. I think we're just jumping a little bit ahead on the itinerary. Regarding the individual level of the BDS diagnostic, I thought I would give you an overview of some of the work that we've been doing in the area of genetic determinants of eating behaviors, not unlike the work that Robert just presented. But for most of the data that I'll be presenting, all of it today, really, just looking at a relatively lean population, and in terms of the phenotypes, looking at consumption patterns. So for most of our work, we've used our cohort in Toronto, the Toronto Nutrigenomics and Health Study, which is funded by AFMNet, one of the networks of centers of excellence. And our current sample size is just over 1,800. Recruitment is ongoing, and our goal is to recruit at least 2,000 individuals, all in their 20s, collecting a variety of information on body weight, food preferences, dietary intake. We've also collected fasting blood samples, from which we look at a variety of biomarkers of exposure and isolate DNA for genotyping. And for genotyping, we use both the candidate gene approach as well as more recently looking at genome-wide scans. So in a subset of our population, we have data using the AFI 6.0, which is the currently the highest density SNP chip available. So as I think is the case with about 90% of the people in this room, we also have a chapter in this book that will be unveiled, I believe, during the cocktail hour, and so ours is chapter 12. And what I thought I would do is give kind of an overview of the work that we did leading up to this, and this chapter essentially focuses on looking at genes affecting a variety of different pathways that can influence ingestive behaviors. So one of the figures that we have there is just, again, looking at the energy balance equation and focusing initially on the intake side of the equation. And what we've done is identified three potential pathways by which eating behaviors or ingestive behaviors could be modified. And, of course, with each of these pathways, one could envision a number of genes that could influence each of these. So although I don't have any genes pointing to the energy expenditure side, there is an active a number of research groups looking at that particular area, and they've identified a variety of genes that do influence individuals' predilection to physical activity and that sort of thing. So if we look at how some of those factors may tip that balance, we started off by focusing on energy homeostasis. And the candidate gene that we looked at here is one of the glucose transporters called GLUT2. And interestingly enough, although this gene has been examined primarily in the context of its role in the pancreas, GLUT2 essentially detects a rise in blood glucose following a meal and pumps out insulin in response to clear away that glucose. But as you can see from this diagram, GLUT2 is also expressed in the brain. A study that was reported a couple of years ago by Bernie Thorne's group in Switzerland showed that mice that have the GLUT2 gene knocked out have impaired feeding behaviors. So when they're injected with glucose, ICV, into the brain, normal mice stop eating. Mice with the GLUT2 gene deleted continue to eat. So we reason that perhaps this common polymorphism, the threonine to isoleucine polymorphism, may be similar to a knockout. Not quite as severe, but perhaps individuals with this polymorphism may have impaired glucose sensing, and that might influence their sugar consumption behaviors. So we started off with this is actually not the Toronto Nutrigenomics and Health Study cohort. This is another cohort that's run by my colleague Tom Wolliver in the Department of Nutritional Sciences, where we have just over 100 men and women, all with newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes, all of them overweight or obese. And this is actually an intervention trial looking at the effects of low and high glycemic index diets. But what we were interested in is just the baseline data. And so the subjects, before they were randomized on the intervention, came in for two separate visits that were 2 weeks apart, and they provided three-day food records from which we looked at just their habitual dietary habits. And interestingly, what we found is that on their first visit, those individuals who were carriers of the isoleucine allele tended to consume more sugars. And going back to a point that Robert made earlier, the importance for replicating gene association studies, we had the opportunity to replicate it within this study because they came in on a separate visit. And once again, this second visit also showed that they consumed higher amounts of sugar. Their protein levels were the same on both visits, and their fat levels were also the same. And so because they did not compensate for this increased sugar consumption by lowering the intake of these other macronutrients, this translated into an increase in energy consumption, significantly so on one visit and borderline so on the second visit. Surprisingly, though, this did not translate into a significantly higher BMI, but perhaps in retrospect it's not so surprising because clearly it's a multifactorial phenotype here, BMI, and all of the participants were overweight or obese, and certainly other factors were contributing here. But again, going back to the notion of the importance of replicating the finding, in this first population, all of them were overweight or obese, and it was a relatively small sample size, just over 100 for a genetic association study. So we did want to replicate this in a second independent population. And here's where we used our Toronto Nutrigenomics and Health Study. And this was over 2 years ago, so our sample size was half of what we currently have. But nevertheless, almost 1,000 individuals, all of them generally lean and generally healthy. And in this particular case, we assessed dietary intake using a one-month food frequency questionnaire. And consistent with the findings from our first cohort, again, we found that those who were carriers of the isoleucine allele consumed just more sugar as part of their diet. We can't really compare the absolute values here with the previous one because it is a not only a completely different population, but it's also a very different dietary instrument. So food frequency questionnaires give slightly different estimates than food records. But once again, protein was the same, fat was the same. In this case, calories tended to be higher, but again, not significantly so. But this is partly, I think, a challenge of using a food frequency questionnaire. And it's a semi-quantitative, doesn't give really reliable estimates in terms of absolute values. But in this particular case, these modest increases in energy consumption did translate into a significantly higher BMI. But as you can see from the numbers, clearly the average of this population is very low. It's a very lean population. So we reported this in Physiological Genomics. It is now just over 2 years ago. And so going back to our original diagram, this is an example of what we've called energy homeostasis. So GLUT2 does not affect an individual's perception of sweetness, even though it influenced sugar consumption. So we've then looked to another pathway that we identified, and in this particular case with the food reward circuits, we focused on another dopamine receptor gene. In this particular case, the DRD2, and we reported this earlier this year in the Journal of Nutrigenetics and Nutrigenomics. And one of the interesting findings here is the mode of inheritance was different between men and women. In the women, we saw this heterosis effect. So the heterozygotes consume the highest amount of sugars compared to either of the homozygotes. This is actually quite interesting because others have reported a heterosis effect with this gene, but for other phenotypes, not sugar consumption. So there seems to be something there. Whereas for the men, there was more of a gene dose effect. So this then covers part of the food reward circuits. And as Robert mentioned to me, his office is actually just down the road from my office, but we see each other only once a year, and it's always here at one of Lorette's functions. And each time we always talk about doing the DRD4 in our cohort. And this time we said, okay, we're definitely going to do it this year. All right, so we're going to do that next week when we go back. So as I mentioned earlier, there are other genes, some of the opioid receptors, serotonin receptors perhaps, that are interesting candidates to look at from the food reward circuits. But moving on to the last pathway that we identified, the sensory perception. And we just got this paper accepted last week in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, where we reported that a common variant in the TAS1R2 part of the sweet taste receptor also influences habitual sugar consumption. And I should mention there is no linkage between any of these genes, so it's not the same person that has the GLUT2 polymorphism that has the dopamine. These are in different chromosomes, and we tested for that issue. We also have a multi-ethnic population in the Toronto cohort, and we always stratify by self-reported ethnicity because many of these polymorphisms are much more common. I think the isoleucine polymorphism of the GLUT2 is virtually non-existent in our East Asian participants. And in this particular case, we found that those with the valine polymorphism consumed less sugar. Again, in two populations. So that really covers the last pathway and a candidate in that pathway. The TAS1R2 is actually a highly polymorphic gene, so there are a number of other variants that could be examined. I should mention that we have looked at other genes. It's not that everyone that we looked at gives us this significant difference. I've just totally ignored all of the negative findings that we've had with other polymorphisms in each of these genes that were not significant. One of the things that we're currently doing is some sensory evaluation. So from the subset of our participants that have had genome-wide scans, we've called in just over 118 of those participants to do sensory studies with a variety of taste modalities, and one of them is sucrose. And so we do threshold detection and super threshold detection. And while I haven't shown here, what we found is, just going back to this study here, the carriers of the valine allele that consumed less sugar, we find that they have a much higher threshold detection of sucrose solutions. So they need to detect a concentration of sucrose that's twice as high as carriers of the isoleucine allele. So it appears that those who have that diminished sensitivity to sweet taste perception, they just consume less sweet-tasting foods. At one point, we thought it might actually be in the opposite direction, but I think there's a good rationale for why it could go in either direction. But nevertheless, there is a consistent story in terms of an individual's perception of sweet taste and how that influences their consumption of sugary foods, and that's largely based on their genetic makeup. So with that, of course, kind of the broader picture is we're interested in how genes influence a variety of taste modalities. We have putative salt taste receptors, and again, we're looking to see how that influences habitual sodium consumption, bitter-tasting foods, sour foods, savory foods as well. And ultimately, we're interested in understanding how that influences a person's risk of a variety of health outcomes. So with that, I'll stop here and thank the members of my group. Karen Ennie was the PhD student who did all of this particular work, and she just finished her PhD this summer and is now doing a postdoc with Andrew Patterson at SickKids. So thank you for your attention.